So Scott Carter will be telling us about a four-dimensional proof of Heron's formula.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity. Actually, Anna asked me to do this, and then she announced something else, and so there'll be a little bit of both within the talk, but neither was really what I had intended to talk about if I was invited back. That's fine. Let's recall a version of Heron's formula. If we have a triangle with edge lengths A, B, and C, then the square of the area of the triangle times a factor of 16 is given by this quartic polynomial at the top, A plus B plus C times etc. And we'll see in the course of the proof that that simplifies to the nine terms that are written down there. 2a squared b squared, 2a squared c squared, 2b squared c squared minus a to the fourth minus b to the fourth minus c to the fourth. So I was at an art and math conference in Tampa a few years ago, and I was eating dinner with Professor Conway, and he said that he would like to see a four-dimensional proof of Heron's formula, so I took this up as a challenge, and my undergraduate student, David Mullins, and I came up with this last summer, so it's kind of fun. So we'll remind you about how to prove the Pythagorean theorem, or how I want to use the proof of the Pythagorean theorem. I want to remind you that the distributive law is a scissors congruence. Our second lemma is really key to this, is if we have the product of two scissors congruences, then that's also a scissors congruence. And I'm going to illustrate that for right triangles, for parallelograms. And then I'm going to take the proof of the Pythagorean theorem and cut it into 25 pieces, the product of the proof of the Pythagorean theorem, cut it into 25 pieces, and reassemble it and show you lots of pictures. And sort of summarize the geometry and the algebra together. So two polygons are scissors congruent if you can cut one into tiny pieces and then re-glue them into the other. We want finitely many pieces, not we're thinking about area from a Euclidean rather than a Newtonian point of view. And at the turn of the previous century, Hilbert asked whether two three-dimensional solids that had the same volume are scissors congruence, and it's now well known that that's false. There's a tetrahedron of volume one, regular tetrahedron of volume one, that can't be reassembled into a cube, and that was proven by Dane shortly after the International Congress. Was it before? Okay.
Before the problem was faced.
Okay. Thank you. This is our main picture here. This is how we're going to prove the Pythagorean theorem by reassembling those five pieces on either one of those squares. And then we're going to fit those 25 pieces inside a hyperrectangle, and then we'll take the 25 pieces out and glue them back together. So I hope that everybody recalls this. If you have children and you're playing with blocks, then you should play with blocks and say, oh, look, we've discovered the Pythagorean theorem. So if we take squares x by x and y by y, cut out a small blue corner, and then cut the resulting rectangles along the diagonals, and we can reassemble them into this figure here. The distributive law is obviously a scissors congruence, right? Top line. And in fact, it's better than that. If we do what is now blasphemously called FOIL, that's just two
applications. No, it's wonderful.
Huh?
It's a beautiful, I was so happy when I learned this. Sorry.
Older people people in the audience realized that it was the distributive law, so applied multiple times. For the sequel, the pictures are going to be 3- and 4-dimensional, and so it's going to be more convenient to dualize the cubes and hypercubes with these little elliptical ovals, and then just denote the corresponding volumes and areas in those regions. So for example, if you want to expand q plus r plus s, t plus u plus v, x plus y plus z, then you would have, 27 pieces. Each one of the ovals that you see indicates the volume of the corresponding piece. And if we look at the right-hand side of the first formula that I wrote, then these are the 81 terms that result here. And it's easy for you to see that the only terms that don't cancel are those 9 terms that are indicated in yellow. Everybody got all the cancellation on that one? Well, they're actually, canceling terms are located in nicely symmetric situations. And the reason for that, of course, is that we're looking at the corresponding volume of the hypercubes. And in this picture, everything is rather precisely color-coded. So if something is homogeneously A, it's got a lot of blue in it. And if it's got some C in it, it probably has some more red in it. And if it's got some B in it, it's got more yellow in it, or something like that. There is a color coding that goes on in here. So after you've labeled all the vertices and color-coded them, and then you just select all the things of the same color, then you can easily see that some of the terms cancel, and some other of the terms cancel. And among these various pictures, then we wind up with those 9 terms that don't cancel. Okay, so the integral of x cubed from 0 to 1 is 1/4. And what is it 1/4 of? Well, it's obviously 1/4 of the volume of the hypercube, because units are given in quartic meters, right? So I was mentioning this to Dylan, I guess, in Hanoi, and he said, do you know a geometric proof that if you take the sum of the cubes from 1 to n, that it's the square of a triangle? I said, I always wanted to do that.
That was me. It wasn't Dylan. We were sitting together in a restaurant, the three of us.
No. Dylan had mentioned it earlier in the day. And I have to admit, Drawer's proof is absolutely the most elegant version of that. The proof is that if you take the cone on a cube and you slice it into two cone on two prisms, then you can rotate one of the prisms and reassemble it, and you'll get a triangle times triangle. Which is essentially what Drawer's proof was. No, we had talked about it earlier in the day. Okay. I recall the discussion in the restaurant. You're right. So if you look at a triangle times triangle, you can see that you can fit 4 triangles times triangles in a hypercube. In fact, if you've got a right triangle times itself, then you can fit 4 copies of a right triangle times itself into a hyperrectangle, where certain of the edge lengths are the same. The fact that it looks like I'm drawing a regular hypercube is just a manifestation of the linear projection. So it doesn't. We can rescale the picture so that this is accurate. So those 4 triangles times triangles fit inside the hypercube. This is my student David's version of this picture, in which it's easy, a little bit easier to read which triangle times triangle fits where. This picture here corresponds to what I have on the blackboard, I hope. Yeah, the indices are correct. And of course, when we're trying to compute the area of a triangle, what we do is we take a copy of the triangle, turn it over, create a parallelogram and say, well, the area of the triangle must be half the area of the parallelogram. And then the other step of the proof is we compute the area of the parallelogram by cutting the parallelogram into a trapezoid and a triangle and reassembling it as a rectangle. So if you have a non-right triangle times right triangle, non-right triangle times itself, then you can fit four copies of that into a parallelogram times parallelogram. And that shows how that fits together. And this is what I was saying about the rectangle and the parallelogram. And so we're going to take the parallelogram times parallelogram that's decomposed into triangle times triangle, triangle times trapezoid, trapezoid times triangle, and trapezoid times trapezoid. Anyone ever seen a trapezoid times trapezoid before? Isn't that neat? That's just a really nice hypersolid there. So we just move these around into various locations into the hyperrectangle. And in fact, when you overlap this hyperrectangle with the corresponding hyperpyramid, the trapezoid against trapezoid doesn't move, and the two figures fit together nicely. Okay, so Pythagorean theorem times Pythagorean theorem. Let's go through this schematically. The blue picture is scissors congruence to the sum of two squares, and the red picture is four triangles and a small square. And so we can reassemble the four triangles and a small square, and we get rectangle times pair of two squares, rectangle times pair of two squares, add in the square times pair of two squares, and you get square plus square times square plus square. Okay? Now, in this picture, we're looking at five pieces. Each of these pieces is a triangle times square. Now that's a triangle times square, that's a triangle times square, that's a triangle times square, that's a triangle times square. This must be a triangle, a rectangle times square, or maybe a square times square, but different sizes. And these five pieces fit inside the corresponding hypercube. And if we include all the lines of the original picture, then it gets kind of messy, but that's what it looks like. And each of those pieces is also correspondingly decomposed into five pieces. So these are the 25 hypersolids that we have in a convenient multiplication table. That table should be self-explanatory.
Yeah.
And when we think about each one of the five pieces that I showed in the first set of slides in that sequence, then we decompose that into five pieces and we can put it inside the corresponding solids as indicated there. So we have rectangle times triangle, rectangle times triangle, square times triangle. Glue those all together and we get square times triangle, square plus square times triangle, and similarly over on this side, again and again, and then we have the little tiny piece, which is square plus square times square, and just in outline, those all fit together to what they're supposed to be, which is square times square. Square plus square times square plus square. Okay, so we've got these nine terms, and the a squared, b squared, the a squared, b squared, the minus a to the fourth, and minus b to the fourth, each decompose into those 25 pieces. That's what I just showed you. The a squared, c squared, and the b squared, c squared also decompose into five pieces. B to the fourth decomposes into 25 pieces, and C to the fourth you don't have to worry about. It doesn't have to be decomposed. So the point of all that is that when you express both A and B as sum of squares, because they are sums of squares, you see, then you can fill the hypersolids and you can recompose them as before. So every one of these algebraic identities is a scissors congruent. So we just showed what those scissors congruences are. And the other pieces are also easy scissors congruents. That's the scissors congruence. And all that junk, the only thing that we need to focus on is 4p squared r squared. 4p squared r squared is 16 times the square of the area of the triangle. Everything's a scissors congruence, and that's the proof of Heron's formula. Now, Anna announced that I was going to give an art and math talk, so I'm just going to briefly go through some.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So, what is the proof of Heron's formula?
I start with a triangle, and then I decompose the triangle as so. Then I recompose that so that it's, when I have triangle times triangle, I have parallelogram times parallelogram, and then I recompose those pieces that are sums of squares into their corresponding pieces.
Is it four dimensional?
Yeah, yeah. Every step in the algebra is four dimensional. Yeah. Now, the actual proof, once you write it down, is the algebraic calculation, admittedly. But the steps are all four dimensional. So, what I had really hoped to talk about is knotted foams in four-dimensional space and branched bricks in five-dimensional space. And I've been thinking a lot about those recently, and in order to think about them, I've started to draw them. So, over here, if we look at the red, yellow, and blue, then that forms the ping pong table that's the dual of a tetrahedron, as in the Mate of Moves, or in probably I first saw that in the Turin and Viron paper. Now, if we let that branch surface persist in time, then we get this branched brick that I'm illustrating here. If we let that branch surface persist in time and then cut that with a cubical piece, so we are actually looking at branched bricks in five space and then let another sheet come through, then the singular area is going to look like the ping pong table. And then this is a projection of a four-dimensional diagram of a five-dimensional knotting phenomenon. Now, yeah, I've made some aesthetic choices and I just want to draw the thing. And I find that when I start drawing these things and start playing with them and just do this as sort of a mental therapy, then all of a sudden I understand the mathematics better. Might take 2 or 3 weeks, but all of a sudden the mathematics becomes very clear. So these are just some drawings that I've made based on those two models. This one I'm rather fond of, but I'm also fond of its brother or sister. And these are the two children together. Now, I don't necessarily advise this, but if you do a cross-eyed stereopsis, you'll get some vibrations in the picture. I'll let you do that for a moment if you so choose. I don't recall exactly what it was, but there was a geometric conference at the Geometry Center, what, about 1990? And there I met an artist named Tony Robin, whose work I had seen before and got very fascinated with. And I'm still trying to emulate what he's done on the canvas, and I haven't succeeded. This is the closest I've gotten so far. Here's another one of our models. At the top of the picture, we see the one side of the Matveyev Perablini move, which corresponds to the union of two tetrahedra along an edge. And at the bottom, we see the other side of that move. So the difference between the top and the bottom is that the yellow sheet is slid forward along this edge. We look at this in time-lapse fashion, and then right here is a singularity. And again, I'm interested in this because this is one of the atomic pieces that I would have if I had a knotted branched brick in 5 space. This would be analogous to non-trivalent graphs. And so these are the pieces that are going to be built up. But I was invited to an art math conference, so I wanted to create some images based on that, which is what I did there. The last of those images is here. And just put a little artificial cartoon shadow so the thing would fill up the canvas. And the canvas size is important because if I don't make them the correct size, then framing them becomes very expensive. There's one more here somewhere. Where is it? Now, with this image, I started out trying to understand this Matveyev move that I drew, but I wanted to understand it from the point of view of the 4 simplex. So in the 4 simplex, I know where my 4 tetrahedra are. I know how to fit each of the duals of the 4 tetrahedra in there. And then I took those 5 pieces and I created one copy of this. And its symmetry was so persuasive that it was impossible to use that image in a non-symmetric way. And so that's what came up as a result of that. And so the moral of the story is, if there is a moral, is that yes, it's good to do pure math and to just be playing with a pencil all the time. But sometimes if you just relax your mind and just go with these ideas and think about them in another context, you'll find maybe some weeks later, maybe some months later, that you understand the mathematics better, or at least that happened to me. So in terms of these ideas of G families of quandals, Masahiko had drawn some movie moves for these relations, and I started looking at the movie moves for the relation, and I said, aha, that's a triangle times a triangle. And I wouldn't have recognized it if I hadn't played with that idea extensively in another context. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Questions? Wait, thanks again.